This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to celebrate a unique man with an incredible life story. Jack Schwartz passed away November 7th at the age of 103, but there were days as a prisoner of war when he wasn't sure he'd make it to 27. Those POW days remained a mystery to his family for decades. His son, Jack Jr., really didn't know any details about his dad's captivity until a trip back to Japan in 2015 to visit some of those prison camps. His then 99-year-old father handed him a typed transcription of the diary he had kept as a prisoner.
Yeah, I was reading it for the first time, and you know, I learned a lot of things, like he raised rabbits, which they would then eat, you know, because they're references to bunny burgers occasionally. He never talked about his experiences. He always downplayed things in terms of the physical nature of the camp. And of course, he was an officer, so he did not have to do a lot of the slave labor. But like at the Kawasaki 2B camp, he was a senior officer. So if something went wrong in the camp, he was the one who was dragged in front of the guards and the prisoners and beaten up. He always did say that two things. One, that he always considered himself to be a lucky POW because he didn't have to go through a lot of things that the enlisted men did in terms of the slave labor and the mines and the stevedores and whatnot. But he also made the point that he never saw the torture that have been reported at other camps. He made a very strong point of that, that while there was malnutrition, horrible living conditions, there was never the torture that is so prominent in many of the stories. So he considered himself very lucky.
What does that make you consider yourself, knowing what he had to endure and overcome for you to ever come into existence?
Well, that's true. If he hadn't survived, I wouldn't have been here.
No, and so many of us listening right now can apply that same dynamic to our existence, whether our ancestors were POWs or just in combat or harm's way in other manners. That is Jack Schwartz Jr., and we're going to hear more from him at the end of the program, but let's hear more from his dad's original interview about how he handled the uncertainty of indefinite imprisonment by the Japanese.
We never thought that we would win a war eventually, even though things were bad, and we didn't know how long it would take. The Japanese called it a 100 years war because what they called it the Eastern China Co-Prosperity Sphere. That's what they called it, and which meant that they were going to take over China and all the Orient, really. And we knew it would be that long, obviously, but there was no idea of how long it would take. But a number of the younger fellows, this was while we were prisoners, a number of the younger fellows didn't get discussed. Discouraged is the word. And I think some died from discouragement. I really do. Because we all had the same amount of food, and some just sort of gave up. In one of the camps I was at, I was in Yokohama for 2 years after, not at first. We lost about one man a month. I think just from discouragement. They had to work, but they all worked. The officers, incidentally, were not put to work. I think that's the only thing of the Geneva Conference the Japs honored. I never knew why, but they did. They made us promise not to escape. Well, that was easy. Where we could escape to an island. Actually, it would have been easy to escape from the camp. Where do you go? You're an American in Japan. Who's not going to recognize you? And a few people did try to escape. They got caught the next day and brought back. Then the whole camp suffered. We had to stand at attention for the whole night long or something like that.
You mentioned guys dying from discouragement. So that begs the question, what kept you encouraged? What helped you believe that you would survive, that you would get home to see your wife again?
I'm not sure. I just think we have faith that we'd get recaptured. I mean, there's no doubt about it, we'd win the war eventually. As I've said, fortunately, I was not ever really sick. And we all lost weight, but we all wanted more food, but it wasn't to the point where we were emaciated. So just had faith, that was all.
And I want to talk to you about some of the conditions of the camps you're in and the way you were treated and what you had to eat and all that. But as far as communicating with your wife back home, was there a point at which you were able to get a letter to her and vice versa? Or were you guys without communication that whole time?
No, actually, we did get to, it was 3 or 4 months after we were captured that the U.S. was notified who the prisoners were. So at least the family knew I was alive. It was quite a bit of time after that when we were each allowed to write a postcard home, which of course was censored, but anyhow, we did write home. And in the course of the whole war, I probably wrote 4 or 5 postcards and got a few letters. I got one package from home. That was about the extent of communication. At least they knew we were alive.
I would imagine, and again, I don't want to put words in your mouth or impose my own understanding on yours, but I would imagine when you're a prisoner on the other side of the world and you've been a prisoner so long that getting a package from home had to be a real serious highlight for you.
Well, sure as heck was. It had food mostly, and basically food. They knew that's what we needed. It only happened once. I think they sent more, but I never got them. And the Red Cross sent packages now and then, but in my almost four years, I got one package. And there were more than that. The Jeffs was confiscated, that was all. When we got the package, of course, it was a big deal. It had, among other things, butter and jam and some meat. And of all things, a package of cigarettes. And I don't smoke then. I didn't smoke now. And so trading went on. I traded a pack of cigarettes for a jar of jam, as I recall it. There wasn't all that much communication, but it was good having even some.
And I'm sure that each camp was different. But when you think back on it all that time, what were the most difficult things that you had to deal with? Were you treated well? Were you abused? How would you describe the way you were handled as a prisoner by your Japanese captors?
Well, the first camp at Sensuji turned out to be just an officer's camp. And the Japanese used that for their show camp. If the Red Cross wanted to inspect a Japanese POW camp, they went to Sensuji. It was practically a country club compared to other camps. So there you have to say that outside of not eating enough, we were not abused, really. In fact, they tried to teach us Japanese, but they gave up after a while. Of course, we learned some things. You had to count off ichi, ni, sa, and shi, and so forth. And we learned the commands, turn right, turn left, sit down, you know, things like that. And a little Japanese. But here's something that's interesting. Once in a while, we got Japanese newspapers printed in English. Of course, this was near the beginning of the war. The Japs were winning all over the place. But we got the news anyway. And even a couple of years later, when I got back to Sensuji, we got 1 or 2 copies. And by then, of course, they were losing the war, and their reporting was quite a bit different. But all in all, I've said ever since I came back that as POWs go, I was a very lucky POW. I was beaten a few times at Kawasaki because I was the senior officer there. And if anything went wrong, they blamed me. And I'd get beaten around the face. Not wounded, really, just beaten up till you fall down and they stop. But the interesting thing is that the Japanese beat their own soldiers. A corporal could beat up a private. Just a different culture, that's all. So I'll say again, not only am I lucky to get back, I was lucky in the way I was treated, really.
Because, in general, Japanese prisoners of the Japanese in World War II had a lot rougher circumstances, in most cases, than prisoners of the Germans did. But you look at even the longest held POW of the war in Japan, you feel like you were fortunate over there. Were you aware that others in Japanese captivity were being treated in worse shape than you were?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we got stories about them. And, of course, I've read many stories about them since then. This was not in Sensuji, but I went to Kawasaki after about 6 months, along with the other 2 civil engineers from Guam, and we never knew why. And we guess it was because they shipped some Navy machinists up there. Maybe they thought engineers were machinists. Anyhow, when we got up, they said, oh, it's a mistake. We'll send you back. Well, they sent my friend Frank back after a year, and they sent me back after 2 years, and the third one stayed there through the whole war, and he was killed by American planes about 2 weeks before the war was over. I mean, Bob had hit the cab. So he lived through the whole war, never got home. So as I say, here I was lucky.
And I imagine when you hear a story like that, when you get that news, there's part of you that says, hey, that could have been me.
Well, sure, it could have been. Here's the other thing I was about to tell you. Up at this camp in Kawasaki, we had an English doctor. He was in the English Navy. How he got there is a different story, which you don't want to know about. But he treated the American prisoners, and he got beat up more than I did because he kept on trying to get prisoners' excuse of going to work. If he tried so hard, he'd get beaten up. He still kept it up. He lived through the war, and later on in 1946, I sent him packages because in England they were really hard up for months after the war was over. So he got care packages from me as a return favor. But as I say, I've always said I was lucky.
Did recommend it. You wouldn't recommend being a POW for almost 4 years?
That's exactly right.
But that said, I imagine there's a lot of perspective that you've carried forward in your life that you wouldn't have if you had not endured all those years without the freedom that you treasure so much now.
I think so, because things that many people take real serious, and by comparison, they're not serious. And that's been my attitude really long.
Did you ever make friends with any of the Japanese guards or soldiers or officers?
Yes, I did. We had an interpreter at this second cabin in Kawasaki. I forget his first name. His name was Kondo. And we got quite friendly, really. And in fact, he treated us pretty well. We talked, and I had learned in prison camp to do a macrame. I don't know if you know what that is.
Sure.
We got a hold of the string, and I was making macrame wristbands. And the Kondo says, "Hey, make me one." I said, "Well, what are you going to do for me?" And I knew what I wanted. I had seen in the papers that some bookstore was selling American books on calculus, and I wanted that.
You wanted a you're in captivity, your wife's back in the States, you barely have anything to eat, and what you want to trade for is a calculus book?
Well, what else I could trade for? So I did, and he got it for me, and I worked every problem in the book. I should have saved the book, but I haven't had it. But it helped pass the time. Actually, in my situation, it was border more than anything else, because the officers didn't have to go to work. But what else was there to do? You sat around. There were only six of us there.
And when you say some guys died from discouragement, that was probably it, that their minds and that idleness went to that place, and you found some more constructive and productive things to do inside your head.
Well, actually, it was the enlisted men who were at work that died. Interesting thing, though, you would talk about attitudes. 1 year to date after the war was over, two of my friends committed suicide, two that had been in camp with me. So it did have a lasting effect on a lot of people. One was living in a room with me. He was a master sergeant from the Philippines. And the other was a Lieutenant J.G., who was captured in Guam, a very wealthy young man, too, incidentally. They committed suicide a year later, so it must have weighed on him very heavily. I was over it by then.
How'd you do that?
Heck, I don't know.
Well, I want to get to that moment of your liberation and everything that transpired from there. But you mentioned food, and I know you lost 50 pounds or so and got down to about 125. But give us a sense of what you did have to subsist on. What kind of food did they give you? And were there moments where you got something out of the ordinary that you appreciated a lot more than you might say now?
Well, basically the food was soup and rice. In fact, it wasn't always rice. As the war went on, we didn't get rice because some sorts of grain we didn't recognize, but it was grain anyhow. And the soup was mostly vegetable soup. I'm not sure if you know what a daikon is, do you? It's a huge white radish.
Yep.
But we had daikon soup day after day after day. And maybe once a month you'd find a tiny piece of fish or meat in it. So the only sick problem I had is I did get beriberi. And in fact, most of the prisoners got beriberi because there was not enough vitamin B in their food. And that beriberi did have an effect on me. It's affected me ever since in my life because it affected my walking. And it used to flare up and disappear. And in the last few years, it hasn't disappeared, so my walking is terrible.
So you told us about the food. You told us how they treated you, that you felt fortunate as an officer to be treated a little better than the enlisted men. How did you deal with not knowing when this war was going to end? And did you ever feel like it should have ended already? This is taking too long? What's going on?
No, actually, believe it or not, I predicted 4 years.
Yeah.
Based on World War One, there's no connection. But somehow that was in my mind. And at our last camp up in Rokorochi, which was very isolated, not even a small town near it. We were up there from June until the end of the war, and the food was no better. And the barracks were even worse. I sent away not so long ago a sketch of the camp that somebody had made. It's in the POW magazines and stuff. And on the upper deck, we each had 22 inches of space. On the lower deck, we each had 25 inches of space. So that's the way it is. If the war had not stopped, We probably would have frozen up there because they got snow up there all the time, and we had nothing for that. But fortunately, the war did stop.
And that's where we'll pick things up after the break. For photos relating to Jack Schwartz's story, you can pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.